there is no constraint. It can go with the stroke of a pen, as we're seeing.
Hi, this is Susan Glasser, and welcome back to the Global Politico, our weekly podcast about the world in the Trump era. That was Lisa Monaco, our guest for this week. She served for the last few years as President Obama's chief homeland security and counterterrorism advisor. She lived in the Situation Room and tells us how she earned the nickname Dr. Doom, what it was like to brief a president who did all the homework, not to mention her views on whether you can win the war on terror, the most dangerous overlooked threat in the world today, and how President Trump might be undoing Obama's legacy with things like his executive order. And of course, we'll talk about the controversial handling by the Obama team of the Russian hacking of the 2016 election. These are the first extensive comments by someone who was in the room at the White House discussing their deliberations over how to handle the hacking and what to make public. Thanks again, Lisa, for joining us this week on the Global Politico.
We're sitting here in your sunny, beautiful, new, temporary new digs at NYU. Where you've taken at least partial refuge after more than two decades in the federal government, watching basically every stage of what used to be known as the global war on terror. I'm not quite sure in the Trump era what exactly it's known as, but you basically had a front row seat to the unfolding of the entire sort of post 9/11 national security order as it's developed in Washington. So here in New York, where you can finally speak frankly and tell us what we really don't understand about this shadowy multi-front war, I want to start, of course, with our unlikely new president and his very, very different view of this war on terror. In his inaugural address, President Trump pledged not only to stop terrorism as a threat, but he said he was going to eliminate from the world radical Islamic terrorism. Is that even possible?
So first, thank you for having me. It's great to be here with you. It's particularly nice, as you noted, to be here in an office with a window. I spent the last 4 years in what we referred to as my cave office in the ground floor of the West Wing, and then I spent the rest of my time in the Situation Room, also no windows, so this is a very nice respite, as you noted. No, I don't think it's possible to eradicate an idea, right? What we can do, though, is rebut it, combat it in many different forms, and which is what I think across two administrations, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, we as a government and as a nation deployed all the tools in our toolkit, to use a hackneyed phrase, to go after threats to the United States, to U.S. persons, to our ideals. And in the last couple of years of the Obama administration, we really doubled down and enhanced our efforts at combating the messaging and the narrative of the murderous group like ISIS. Because that's really where we have to compete on the stage of ideas. But we're not going to be able to eradicate an idea. We can combat it. We can debunk it. We can add different information and other information combating getting into a debate on the ideas is something we can do. But to eradicate an idea, I don't know that we'll be able to do that.
There's so much to talk about. I want to back up and explain to people a little bit how you got into this position. But let's just finish this line of inquiry here. Did President Obama create the Islamic State? Because that's what Donald Trump said.
No. And in fact, you're right to kind of step back, and your listeners hopefully can benefit from a little history here. The Islamic State started out as al-Qaeda in Iraq and operated for years, frankly killing our soldiers in Iraq, and through a series of breaks and breaches with the mothership, frankly, of al-Qaeda Corps operating in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and basically because of the failure of the prior Iraqi government to address the grievances of the Sunni minority in Iraq, really rolled through, as we saw in 2014, Iraq to establish what they have called, and their leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, has called a desire to create a caliphate, an Islamic state, first in Iraq and Syria and then more globally. So the conditions for ISIS and the Islamic State were set long ago. They originated as part of al-Qaeda in Iraq and then were, I think, probably fostered by, frankly, the lack of attention to Sunni grievances in Iraq.
Well, and I'm sure there's been a lot of second guessing inside the Obama administration about that question, about whether the United States should have found a way to conclude its deal with the Iraqi government and keep more forces, and whether that would have avoided this. There's also, President Obama had his own sort of mission accomplished moment, right, where he declared that, in effect, al-Qaeda had been defeated. So did then Secretary of Defense and former CIA Director Leon Panetta. Clearly, it's morphed rather than dying and disappearing, which goes to your point about not defeating an ideology. It's interesting, though, for Obama, people don't focus on that. Tell me, at that moment, was there a big internal awareness like, oh, maybe we shouldn't be saying that?
Well, I will tell you, in my role as the person who's responsible for counterterrorism and advising the president and responding to crises and marshaling the resources and coordinating the government, responding to counterterrorism crises, everything from the Boston Marathon bombings to the campaign against the so-called, the nomenclature I like to use is the so-called Islamic State, because I don't want to give them the benefit of their branding. I am, as a kind of a condition of my job, constantly concerned about what we're not seeing and what might be around the corner and the attack that could happen, because they only have to be right once, which is a familiar term, and we have to be right in the government as counterterrorism professionals all the time. So I am kind of constitutionally set up to be worried about declaring any victory. That said, it is certainly true that core al-Qaeda, the group, the leadership, the entity that perpetrated the 9/11 attacks, has been decimated. But all the while, as we've seen, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and now its largest affiliate, al-Qaeda in Syria, has morphed and has expanded and is finding a safe haven in Syria, which is why we have to continue to keep the pressure up there.
So you mentioned the Boston Marathon bombing. I believe that was maybe your first week or even
my third week.
Yeah, my third week on the job.
Yeah, so I was a veteran by then. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that job. You mentioned the windowless situation room and the windowless cave in which you operated. What is the information flow bombarding you in that? How closely did you work directly with President Obama? Mm-hmm. How much does it matter who the president is?
Yeah. So my role, as I said, was as the president's Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Advisor. What that meant...
And this was basically created, in effect, by the Bush administration.
Yes. Yeah. So it was one of the reforms and one of the creations post 9/11. And the idea was, and Tom Ridge, who was the first Homeland Security Secretary, had the job in the White House before they set up the Department of Homeland Security and before he became secretary. It was created to have a locus, a point of focus, and accountability in the White House with direct and immediate access to the president on those issues, on homeland security issues. Now, the concept of homeland security has morphed in the 15-plus years since 9/11, but for me and for my immediate predecessors, John Brennan in the first term of the Obama administration, and for those who held the job in the Bush administration, Fran Townsend, Ken Weinstein, both former colleagues and friends of mine, it really encompassed everything from domestic terrorism attacks like the Boston Marathon bombings to overseas terrorism attacks where U.S. persons might be at risk, to cybersecurity, to natural disasters, to pandemics. So
A modest portfolio.
Yes, a wide portfolio that earned me basically the name Dr. Doom from the president, because every time he saw me coming, he knew something bad had happened.
How often would you see him in the course of a day?
Well,
there's a lot of bad things that happen.
Yeah. Well, every day I would see him, and every morning. So I participated along with the National Security Advisor, the Deputy National Security Advisor, the Chief of Staff, the Vice President, in the President's daily brief. So this is the first meeting the President would have usually in the morning, and it would be a meeting with his National Security staff, the folks I mentioned, and the Director of National Intelligence, or his deputy. And it would begin with a description overnight of what had kind of come in over the transom overnight and things that the Director of National Intelligence wanted to brief the President on, as well as larger strategic questions and trends. And then it would evolve into a discussion where the President would want to know what was on our minds. And he would ask me, what am I worried about? What guidance do I need from him? What should he know about what was going to be unfolding over the course of the day? What were we concerned about? And what I found is I would spend a lot of time every morning preparing for that meeting, because you want to use that time with the president wisely.
There's a sense that's evolved that seems pretty well documented, that Obama was both a voracious consumer of written material in preparation for this presidential daily brief, and also that he did take a sort of a brainy constitutional law professor's interest in these matters, that he was pretty precise, that he was pretty involved. Some people have even said he would micromanage. What was your takeaway from dealing with him?
So he was a voracious consumer of written information, but that wasn't confined to the President's daily brief. That was true across the board. For every meeting you would have with him, he would consume that paper that he was provided. He would get a multiple inches thick binder every night for the next day's meetings with memos and papers for him to consume in advance of all the meetings he would have that day. And he consumed it. Without fail, if you gave him written product, he had consumed it. I likened it to appearing before a tough judge every day. So I'm a former prosecutor, and so I'm used to having that give and take and being making sure I am able to provide the answer first and then provide my explanation. The president, engaging with the president was very much like appearing before a tough judge every day.
Well, the reason I'm asking this about Obama, obviously, is because we now have a successor who is very different both in style and temperament and in how he consumes information and in what he is saying about the policy. So how much does it matter who the president is when it comes to the kind of issues that you were presenting each day?
Mm-hmm. Look, I think it matters very much that you have somebody in that role who is willing to engage in informed debate and discussion, to rely on experts, to value subject matter expertise, to have an eye to what the institutional roles are, not as a straitjacket, but as a guide, to be respectful of norms. All of those things, I think, are important when ultimately the commander-in-chief has to make the weightiest decisions there are in our government, whether to send troops into harm's way, whether to, act with executive power in a way that is unique in our system of governments.
So let's get specific. We don't know all the details yet, but it does appear that President Trump has changed some of the ways that decisions are being made. The Pentagon seems to be more empowered to launch decisions when it comes to stepping up airstrikes or targeting in the ongoing fight against the Islamic State in both Syria and Iraq. There's a sense that perhaps there is a looser set of criteria where the Pentagon has more power. There's certainly a narrative in Washington that has emerged that, well, President Obama was a kind of a micromanaging meddler, and, you know, Trump is going to let the professionals handle that. Do you see any specific evidence of that? And are you worried about the increase in civilian casualties as a possible consequence?
So I think a lot remains to be seen. I don't think we know quite yet how this is shaping up. I will say I think every new team and new president and his team ought to reevaluate how they want to structure things. And it is not a bad thing in and of itself to delegate, obviously, to the professionals. And that ought to be the case. There ought to be a policy. The way I think it works best is when the National Security Council operates to inform the president of a set of options or make recommendations after a process where all the views have been heard. So, for instance, the Department of Defense and the intelligence community, they're likely to be the first ones to tell you that they don't have all of the equities, to use a Washington term, in a particular debate, and they want to understand what the diplomatic fallout may be from a certain course of action, what the ramifications will be down the line. And that all gets hashed out at the National Security Council table in the Situation Room.
Well, that did. Is it clear to you that that is still occurring?
It's not clear to me what process has been laid out. I think, while I don't know General McMaster, everything I've read indicates that he wants to have a full process and use the National Security Council in the way that it has been done over past administrations. I think that's all to the good. Having chaired many, many, many hours of meetings in that Situation Room, either in the Deputies Committee context or in my role as Homeland Security Advisor, chairing the Principals Committee on Homeland Security issues, I can tell you that the best decisions are a result of a very full, transparent, and inclusive process.
By the way, did people were sort of arguing over this at the time? What's your view about Trump's initial restructuring of the Principals Committee? This sounds like one of those arcane Washington debates, but does it matter or not? Does the CIA director belong on the Principals Committee?
So I think it matters in the following way. One is, you know, there's a lot of controversy. Should Bannon be on a formal member of the Principals Committee, et cetera? What role should the DNI have, the Director of National Intelligence, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff? First, every president can structure that Principals Committee the way he wants it. If the president wants a particular advisor's view, he or she can get that, whether or not they're in as a formal member of the Principals Committee. And I've seen that happen. The problem, I think, or the danger and the concern we should have in how we structure it in the written product that we all looked at is the signal it sends. So what signal, I think the question that should be asked is, what signal is the White House sending to career professionals in the intelligence community, at the Department of Energy, and around the national security community, if you downgrade and don't have the Director of National Intelligence at the table, if you don't have the Secretary of Energy on the Principals Committee, even though the Energy Department is responsible for our nuclear arsenal? So what signal are you sending to subject matter experts, to the career professionals who you need to invest in the process, to have bought into your policy decisions? That's the concern I would have.
Well, you talk about signal sending. Obviously, the biggest signal sent by President Trump involves the very delicate subject of Russia and its intervention in the U.S. presidential campaign. And the president of the United States is on record as saying that the conclusion of our intelligence agencies, and 17 of them, I believe, is he doesn't agree with it, and he thinks that they don't produce the kind of information that he thinks is reliable. This is unprecedented. I'm sure you've been grasping, as we all have, for historical examples or things like that. You saw many incidents of infighting inside the national security bureaucracy over everything, I'm sure, from resources and money to policy issues. am I missing something? I mean, we're talking about signal sending on the one hand. On the other hand, it seems almost antiquated, right? I mean, we've got a president who seems to be almost openly at war with his own national security bureaucracy.
So I share the concerns of some of my former colleagues who've commented on this, which is that episode, and to the extent it continues, it is very concerning. If you're sending a signal to the intelligence community, the career professionals, that you don't value their work or you are questioning their work. Now, I should say there absolutely should be skepticism about intelligence products. There should be a give and take. There should be a robust discussion. But it ought to come from a place of informed debate and discussion, right? The president is owed the best, most rigorous analysis from the community, from the intelligence community. And they are owed, I believe, a fair and open discussion with the policymakers about that. But to devalue the work of 16 agencies and career professionals without seemingly any basis is, I think, a concern for what needs to be a healthy, candid, and relationship of trust, quite frankly.
Right. And so, okay, let's talk about Russia, though. So, first of all, a lot of people have wondered, Democrats and Republicans, why did it take so long for us to seem to understand the nature of this Russian penetration of our democratic institutions, and specifically the Democratic Party? Was that a failure of our system or a failure of a sort of category understanding, right? Like, did we – clearly it took a long time for the FBI to get to the right people at the DNC in the narrow example. What do you think about that to start? And then I do want to ask about the policy debate, not the, you know, substantive discussion of these still classified, understandably, matters, but the policy debate about going public and what your particular position was. We know there were lots of different points of view being expressed about whether the president should speak more forcefully before the election.
So to your first question, I think that for some years now, the intelligence community has identified Russia as an increasingly aggressive actor, particularly in cyberspace. And we've seen, whether it's in Ukraine, whether it's in their intervention in Syria, on a host of levels, what they've been doing elsewhere in Europe, their aggression and, tactic of flouting international norms. So I don't think there was that we were kind of late to the game on that. As to the particular investigation of the hacking, that is something that, you know, we treated very much in the way that we have done other malicious activity by cyber actors. In other words, we applied the same framework that we have in other contexts, whether it was China stealing intellectual property, whether it's Iran committing denial of service attacks on our financial institutions, whether it's North Korea in the Sony attack. And we said, FBI and intelligence community, you need to get to the bottom of this, employ all the tools, intelligence, law enforcement, to understand what do we know has happened. How can we attribute, can we attribute who the actor was? And then can we say it publicly in a way that will give the public and our adversaries confidence that we, in fact, know what we're talking about without violating or exposing sources and methods that won't allow us in the future to make that same attribution? So we applied a framework and a playbook that we have done many times. Now, there has been this theory that we didn't do anything, which I take issue with, right? So there was considerable work done all throughout the summer, both private messaging at the highest levels, as the president and others have talked about, and substantial engagement with the Congress and substantial engagement with state and local officers and governments and those who, frankly, manage, hold, own, and operate the electoral system and the election process, because our first goal was to make sure that the integrity of the election was not undermined.
Well, it's interesting because if you talk to, as I did recently for this podcast, to Congressman Schiff, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, he and Dianne Feinstein actually put out a statement in September. And what they say, what he told me in this interview, was they wouldn't have done that had they successfully gotten the White House to do that instead. And so there was already a robust behind-the-scenes debate about going public, not with getting ahead of your skis in terms of what the information was, but going public with what you were already privately working on. And, you know, he said very clearly, the National Security Council stopped me from, you know, being able to pursue that. Said, no, absolutely shut that down. President Obama wasn't going to do anything more. That's why they released their statement. Then, of course, a few weeks later, President Obama did come in. Did you, you must have participated in meetings where this was discussed. Does that look like a mistake in hindsight? Did you, and also, did you have a personal point of view that you expressed?
So I think people forget, somewhat amazingly, that on October 7th, the Director of National Intelligence, the Secretary of Homeland Security, backed up by the full intelligence community, issued an unprecedented statement in declaring quite clearly that Russia, including at the highest levels, was engaged in a campaign to try and influence our election. And what we were very focused on in doing that, and that was a very purposeful approach, and we relied on the intelligence community and law enforcement to say, what are you comfortable saying based on your investigation, and what can be said that will not hinder our national security going forward, right? So that was an unprecedented statement. I think it got lost a little bit in, I think this on the same day, the Billy Bush tape came out. So that is, I think, a fact that sometimes gets lost in this discussion. So there was an unprecedented statement and repeated and regular briefings of Congress all the way along at the classified level about what was going on. But our focus, as I said, was really to make sure that the election process was not undermined, because here's the thing. Whatever else was a subject of debate about motive, we knew and everyone agreed that the one of the goals that Russia had in all of this was to undermine confidence in our democratic process, to sow discord, to sow confusion. And so we were very conscious that we not do their work for them by creating a partisan discussion about this. So the Schiff and Feinstein statement, I think one of the concerns was that it was not bipartisan.
Right.
And my own view on that is we did not want to do anything to do the Russians' work for them by engaging in partisan discussion about this, which is why we were so intent upon getting bipartisan support, and ultimately we did so from the House and Senate leadership, in trying to get the state and local governments to work with us to shore up their cybersecurity. We made a specific effort to go to Congress to say we want bipartisan support for state governments to take us up on our offer to shore up their cybersecurity and their election systems, because there was a tremendous amount of resistance. This is an election year. I think there was a view that if we came to state and municipal governments and said, we want to help you shore up your cybersecurity for your election system, they viewed it as a big federal takeover. We really needed bipartisan support for the efforts we were making, largely out of the Department of Homeland Security. Ultimately, that turned out to be a smart way of doing business, and we ended up having 48 of 50 states take us up on our offer. But we needed bipartisan support to do it.
It's a funny word, bipartisan, at this moment in time where you now have the president, President Trump, making the another unprecedented accusation, which is that his predecessor, President Obama, in effect, wiretapped him. That was the specific language of President Trump's tweet. Other officials from the Obama administration have said that is categorically not true. Even Republicans have said there's no evidence to suggest that, except also the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee has said, no, there actually is some evidence. This is a very confusing situation to all of us bystanders. Lisa, did you wiretap President Trump?
No.
And you personally?
Not me personally, not President Obama, as we've seen now from Director Comey to Director Rogers and across the board. I think finally, thankfully, we actually have had bipartisan statements about the ludicrousness of that accusation. And we've had Director Comey and others really debunk that statement.
Now, you bring up Director Comey. Of course, you know, one of the questions that a lot of people have is basically, well, isn't it Director Comey who sort of tarnished the ability of the FBI or our other institutions to be perceived as nonpartisan actors by appearing to intervene in the election beforehand with his unprecedented statement about the Clinton investigation when he failed to acknowledge publicly the Trump investigation at the same time? You know, there must have been debates and concern inside the White House about this. Your former colleagues at the FBI, where you worked for many years, I'm sure have strong opinions on this. What is your personal view of it, and what does it mean for the institution?
So I'll comment on the institutional piece here. I think as you noted, I've worked in the Justice Department and the FBI for almost my entire career before I went to the White House. And I have worked for and had mentors as disparate as Janet Reno and Bob Mueller. You can't think of two more different on the outside individuals. But one thing that a number of things they had in common and really instilled in me was a reverence for the institutional role of the department and the FBI, a component part of the Department
of
Justice.
Well, that's why you must be just blown away by, you know, the conversations that we're now having about these as, in effect, partisan actors.
Well, and I think that's regrettable because I don't think Jim Comey is a partisan actor.
You don't think that?
I do not. I think that it is very important to preserve the unique role that the Justice Department and its component parts plays in our government. It's unlike any other cabinet institution or cabinet agency. It is both has a policy role to implement the priorities of the president, whatever priority that may be, and a role as an independent investigator and prosecutor, which should be completely walled off from partisan political considerations and from White House interference. And that is, it is so critical that the Justice Department maintain that role, that unique place it has in our system, and that it be perceived that way. So to the extent that the events over the last year have tarnished that in any way, I think that's really regrettable. And we need to be very focused on making sure that we restore that to the extent it needs to be restored and are focused on keeping that dual role really as a priority one.
What is another possible explanation for why Comey would have talked about the Clinton investigation before the election and not the Trump investigation? What are we missing?
So, I mean, I can't comment on it other than to point to what I think Director Comey has said, which is he's made a distinction about closed investigations versus not closed investigations. And so I'll leave it at that. I do think that it's really important in these instances to be guided by precedent, be guided by standard operating procedure, as wonky or as bureaucratic as that sounds. There's a reason that you set up
those frameworks. That's the classic thing, right? You'll miss it when it's gone, right?
You miss it when it's gone, and those procedures and the standard process is not there for the easy cases. It's there for the hard cases. And I participated in many discussions in my former roles where, you knew you'd be damned if you do, yet damned if you don't. You could choose either path and be criticized, but if you were following the process that has been adhered to before, you would have that at your back.
Okay, so it's hard for us not to escape from the Trump factor hanging over all these things. But here's another issue that has sort of straddled the two administrations, and you were involved in setting this policy under Obama. I'm talking about admitting refugees into the United States. Donald Trump's initial executive order, his list of seven countries, he explicitly said, well, that list of countries was made by the Obama administration. In fact, Lisa, you were part of those conversations about what we needed to do to allow people in from other countries. Is this your list? Where is Trump getting this from? And what do you make of his policy targeting people from these seven countries, many of which do not, in fact, have a record of being the kind of people who have actually caused attacks inside the United States?
So there's been a lot of confusion on this topic. And I've signed on to a friend of the court brief about the travel ban. And
that's in the case that's still pending.
Correct. And basically, along with a bipartisan set of national security officials spanning past administrations, saying that I think that there is not a national security case for either the first or second ban. You ask about these seven countries, now six. Iraq haven't been taken off the list. The critical distinction here is that is a list of countries that the Obama administration identified working with Congress that either were state sponsors of terrorism or we thought needed to have additional vetting applied. Importantly, there was never a ban, an across-the-board ban, from admittance of nationals of those countries.
But that was a list that originated where in the Obama administration?
It started some countries from Congress, mm-hmm. and then some were added by the Obama administration. But the point of creating that list was to say, we were very concerned, and this came about after the Paris attacks, and we were very concerned about the foreign fighter and continue to be very concerned about the foreign fighter problem. These are individuals who leave their country of origin and travel to Iraq
right.
and Syria.
So foreign fighters not coming into the United States, but leaving their home countries, going to Iraq or Syria, and then returning.
And then returning to their home country. The best example of this, of course, being the attacks in Paris and in Brussels, where you had French nationals, Belgian nationals, who had traveled from those countries to Iraq and Syria and come back to perpetrate these attacks. So what we were concerned about is identifying those travelers, and if they are a passport holder, for instance, of France, and they travel to Syria, and come back, we're very concerned about them coming back and either perpetrating an attack in Europe or in the United States. We have something in our system called the Visa Waiver Program. So you can be a national from the UK, for instance, and not have to apply for a visa to come to the United States. Well, if you had traveled to Syria to get training, we'd want to identify that as being an indicator that there may be additional vetting that needs
right.
to happen.
But if you were concerned, I mean, a lot of people have looked at this and said, well, if this is a list, though, about places where foreign fighters come from, or it's a list of places where terrorist attacks might have originated against the United States, it's still hard to understand how that list would not include Saudi Arabia
sure.
or Egypt, except for politics.
Well, I think it was an effort both, working with Congress and working with professionals both at the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security to say, what are the areas that we're most concerned about travel to if you are somebody who wouldn't normally have to get a visa to come to the United States? So we're concerned about travel to Yemen. We're concerned about travel to Syria. In order, and what that might say about your background and coming into the United States. So what we did is we working with Congress, arrived at those seven countries and said, if you normally would be allowed to come to the United States without getting a visa, but you have traveled to one of those countries, we're going to say, no, you now need to get a visa. And you're not going to be allowed to travel to the United States on the visa waiver program. So it was an effort to put in more vetting for those individuals who had evinced a particular action that was potentially
a concern.
So it was
a specific group of people you meant to have the enhanced vetting of and not the entire category of citizens
Correct.
From those countries.
Correct. And this is something that a point we made in the front of the court brief and in a declaration that was filed, which is to say there ought to be rigorous vetting. We should constantly be looking at enhancing the vetting for people who want to come to this country. But we need to do it smartly in a way that's informed by threat, by intelligence, by specific indicators, and do it in a tailored way. Because if we don't, we risk very real backlash from our partners who we need in the fight against terrorism, who we need to combat terrorist safe havens in their own countries.
So you mentioned Syria. Obviously, this was one of, if not the most long-running and difficult policy decision for President Obama in the Middle East, persistently since that here's this civil war metastasizing, here's this growth of this new terrorist threat that is both within Syria from the Islamic State, but obviously threatens not only countries in the region, but Western Europe, potentially the United States as well. Do you see that as a failure, a foreign policy failure on the part of the Obama administration? What does your own after-action report look like?
I think it was one of the hardest problems that we confronted. And it is one of the most vexing issues from a terrorism perspective, from a foreign policy perspective, from a humanitarian perspective. And, you know, we looked at this and chewed over options and had endless discussions and changed our approach, added new tools, retooled actions we were taking, pressed the intelligence community, the military to come forward with options. And it is such a complex environment with, you know, it's been described at least three different civil wars going on in some way, shape, or form in the country, that those who think that there's an easy solution are very sorely mistaken. And the approach that was taken, I think, was really guided by one issue, which is what is in our national interest. And President Obama felt very strongly that our first priority was to protect this country from attacks. So going after Al-Qaeda in Syria, external operations plotters, going after ISIS in Iraq and Syria, both because of the threat they pose to us here in the homeland as well as to our neighbors, but to do so in a way that does not draw us in to a broader conflict.
Well, and this is a great example, right, of where the president personally clearly was driving those decisions. It's been widely reported that at various points, many of his top advisors urged him to take measures which he refused to do, whether it was providing more direct military assistance to certain groups or imposing a no-fly zone. This came up for many years, even predating your mm-hmm. role in this job. Did you observe that dynamic firsthand, that it was sort of Obama versus a lot of the other people at that sit room table?
What I observed on this issue in particular, but not confined to this issue, was a lot of robust debate with lots of views being shared and sometimes from unlikely quarters, right? So those who want to prioritize the humanitarian concern and intervening militarily to relieve that might take a different view from those in the military, for instance, who do not want to and have realized the very real downsides to our national interests and to our troops to getting drawn in. So it was not a Obama versus, but rather an exceptionally robust set of debates over many years.
And where did you come down?
Look, I think that my first and foremost concern has always been on the counterterrorism, given my role. And I was very focused on making sure we were doing everything, as the president was, to disrupt plots emanating from Syria in particular, from Al-Qaeda in Syria, and taking our approach there that in a way that would prioritize the disruption of the terrorism threat.
Back in 2009, President Obama promised the families of 9/11 victims and coal victims that this was going to be a rule of law approach and that there was going to be justice. It was going to take place in the court system. Now it's 2017. Those trials haven't even started yet. Is there anything that can be done to move it forward? Is that a big disappointment for you personally?
Well, I think it is tremendously troubling and heartbreaking, I suspect, for many of the families of the 9/11 victims to not have seen justice done in the 9/11 case yet. We should not lose sight of the fact that over the Bush administration and the Obama administration, there have been many instances of doing justice for terrorism victims. And we have used what we call the Article III, our criminal justice system, to great effect, both for seeking justice for terrorism victims and getting intelligence. The 9/11 case itself, though, stands in contrast. I was somebody who believes very strongly that we ought to be able to use a whole range of tools. So I am and have defended in the past the military commission process as it was reformed under the Obama administration, working with bipartisan senators like Lindsey Graham and others. I believe you can have a military commission process, as we did in reforming that statute, that has appropriate protections in it. It has proven, however, to be something that has not worked very well in effect, right? We have not seen, while the process has started, it has been one of fits and starts in Guantanamo.
Well, that's right. And in fact, the fact that Guantanamo still exists, even though both President Bush and President Obama said very strongly and clearly they were going to close it. Yeah. Now you have President Trump. I don't think he's ever mentioned it. He certainly is not vowing to close it, as far as I'm aware.
No, he has said that he wants to add more people to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think that will happen?
No, I don't know. I think that he'll likely have people advising him that actually could create real problems from a legal perspective in terms of a detention authority. And, we through the course of the Bush administration and the Obama administration, went from the 242 at the beginning of the Obama administration down to 41. And the vast majority of those individuals held in Guantanamo today are those who a unanimous group of President Obama's national security team said are too dangerous to let go. So I think that we made really substantial progress in addressing what was, as you pointed out, both the goal of the Bush administration and the Obama administration to close it.
So as a candidate, President Obama obviously had a lot of concerns about the broad scale and sweep of the executive powers that President Bush used to launch the global war on terror. As president, he reformed some of those. You mentioned the military commissions as one example. But broadly speaking, the president, whether it was Obama or Bush, has had enormous, unprecedented powers to wage this shadowy new kind of war. Does it look differently to you now that it's President Trump wielding those powers?
It's an interesting question, right? I think every president comes in and wants to both understand the limits and exercise the limits of his power. And certainly President Obama was very focused on what could be sustainable use of that power and what constraints could apply. And he constantly focused us on having a sustainable counterterrorism strategy. That meant working with partners where we could, but acting unilaterally where we must to protect the American people. That meant having, always observing the legal floor, if you will, is something a legally available option, but then saying, does it make sense to do this? Should we impose another policy threshold in addition to having the legal floor? I think President Obama constantly talked in terms of having a framework that could be sustained over time, and you saw him do that both in the counterterrorism campaign against ISIS, in the way he pushed us to have a framework around the use of lethal action against terrorism subjects, terrorism targets rather, and in intelligence collection. So he was very interested in making sure that there was a sustainable approach to this, and that there would be constraints on his successors.
But do you feel like you created a new framework of constraints on Trump, that he has less power than Obama walked in the door with?
Well, look, so many of in this area, so much of this is by executive order, right? So there is no constraint.
Right.
It can go with the stroke of a pen, as we're seeing. That said, you do create a focus on what are the good strategic reasons to have these constraints. So, for instance, the Department of Defense, you asked about civilian casualties earlier. Our military is the most professional, discriminating force in history, because they recognize that it is in our strategic interest as a country to be attentive to civilian casualties, because to do otherwise feeds a propaganda machine. To do otherwise,
right, but no one's going to order them to create civilian casualties. The question is, what is the vetting? What is the process? What is the level of engagement,
sure,
of the president in launching these operations? Or in
so I think that President Obama did what he could and what we could do to set up those expectations. So having a transparent process that said, here's how we've used force, here's how we've articulated it, here's how we've tried to adhere to international
right,
law.
Right, but somebody can come in and say, well, I don't care. You guys decide.
Yes, they can. Yeah. And that's our system, right? And the people who voted for
right.
that will see that result. What you can do is set up a transparent process. So there's an expectation, as we've seen. President Obama issued an executive order in the last year of his presidency that said there will be a report every year on the number of civilian casualties that happen in areas outside of active hostilities. There's now an expectation for that report, and you have outside actors, some in the press, some in the in civil society, in the humanitarian community. So there can be pressure, some in Congress who welcomed that report. There can be expectation and pressure put on policymakers and a new administration to hold true to that. It may or may not happen, but you at least set up an expectation and a discussion to happen, which is as it should be in our government.
So let's just a final lightning round then,
sure,
if you will. What are a few things that if Trump were to change them would be truly significant in your view? You talked about how much of this can be done or undone by executive order. What should we be looking for as a guidepost to say, well, that really matters, as opposed to it's just kind of today's Twitter hysteria? Are there two or three things that you're watching?
So one, on the cybersecurity front, I think maintaining the progress that we achieved in holding adversaries to account and using all the tools in our arsenal to do so, whether it's law enforcement, criminal indictments, as we did with China, whether it's sanctions, as we did with North Korea and Russia. So keeping that drumbeat and making sure that you have the relationships as a president, as an administration, with those who are going to be instrumental in keeping that pressure on internationally to continue to the work on setting up norms in cyberspace, and with the private sector for information sharing. So keeping that pressure on and being willing to impose costs, whoever the adversary is, in the malicious cyberspace, I think is critically, critically important. on, you talked about civilian casualties. I think it would be a mistake to throw out the policy construct that the president, President Obama, put in place to make sure that there is rigor around civilian casualties outside of areas of active hostilities. Because I think ultimately you can, it does us a disservice with our partners and with the population that we need to help us fight in the war on terror. So those are a few areas that I think I'd be watching for.
We haven't talked a lot about, you know, this sort of scary world of threats that you saw every morning in the president's daily brief. But, you know, what are a couple examples of things that sort of keep you up at night, even though they're not necessarily front page headlines in this very engaging spectacle of transition from one presidential administration to another? What about the rest of the world? What, you know, what do you worry about?
So one of the things, and I said this to my successor, is terrorism threats, regrettably, continue to be with us. And we're in a new phase in that, in terms of social media-inspired terrorist attacks from ISIS and the like. Cyber threat is an exponentially growing concern that we have. But what I told my successor is you need to add a third thing to your list, and that is emerging infectious disease. And I say it quite precisely that it is emerging infectious disease. In other words, it doesn't need to be maliciously introduced. You don't need to have a terrorist or a criminal actor trying to do something bad with a pathogen. As we saw with Ebola, with Zika, there can be tremendous resources and panic and loss of life as a result of a new disease that we're seeing as a result of whether it's climate change or increased transportation or human beings living in more developed areas. All of that combines to make a very threatening world when it comes to emerging infectious disease. We've got 100 years ago, 1918, you had the Spanish flu. 50 million people died.
I know. That's not a typo. 50 million.
50 million people died. In Ebola, 12,000 people died. One of them was in the United States. And we need to really be grappling with this threat and to do so from a fact-based and a science-based way. And that means working with partners. Right, the global health security agenda that the Obama administration started is critically important because just like terror threats that start overseas that we're worried about coming here, the same is true with emerging infectious disease. And we've got to be looking at working with partners, funding critically work of partner nations to up their defenses.
If you could do over one thing, what would it be?
Well, it's interesting. There'd probably be a lot on that list because I'm far from perfect and the world is an incredibly complex place. I think the war in Yemen that continues is something that is really heartbreaking to see. And I think we're seeing a humanitarian disaster unfold there. And while it's critically important that we work with our partners, the Saudis, to defend their territory, We've got to be focusing on that and the humanitarian disaster that's unfolding there.
So it's nice to have a sunny office and a nice window, but what do you miss about the White House? Is there anything that you...
So I miss my colleagues, right? It was a wonderful team. You know, it's like working in a submarine because you never really kind of come up from the surface, but it was a tremendous group of colleagues both inside the West Wing and around that Situation Room table. I think we were doing our best work when we came together as a team to really hash through really tough issues, but to do so with integrity, which I hope we did, and I think we strive to do, and to arrive at either the best consensus recommendation or the best thought through options for the president. And that was a privilege to be able to do that every day.
Lisa Monaco, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of The Global Politico. And
thanks.
Thank you, of course, to all of our listeners. We're delighted to have you with us. We hope you'll give us feedback and comments, criticisms, ideas for future guests. You can email me anytime at sglasser@politico.com. And, of course, we hope that you'll subscribe to The Global Politico at iTunes or just look for us on Politico's homepage. Thanks again. Mm-hmm.